Democracy Now!, Covering the Movement's Changing America Tour. I'll be speaking today at 2 p.m. at Carleton College in Minnesota and at 6:30 p.m. at Augsburg College in Minneapolis. Then on Saturday, we're on to Madison at 1:30 p.m. and in Chicago at 7 p.m. And Sunday, I'll be speaking in Michigan in three cities, in Kalamazoo at 11 a.m., in Lansing at 2 p.m., and in Grand Rapids at 5:30 p.m. On Monday night, I'll be speaking at the Philadelphia Free Library at 7:30. And then on Wednesday, May 10th, I'll be speaking at Seattle Town Hall in Washington. On Friday, May 12th, I'll be speaking at the New School in New York City. You can go to our website, check all the details at democracynow.org. Then we're on to Oregon and California. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Trina Nadura, and Andre Lewis. Special thanks to Dennis Moynihan, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, and Paul Huckabee, our engineers. Thanks to Becca Staley and Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello and welcome to another edition of the new WHFR Journal. It's our public affairs show. We talk about all things local to Dearborn and the surrounding area. Not just the weekly news, which we get from several different sources, including the two weekly newspapers that publish in this area, the Press and Guide and also the Times Herald, but also the Downriver paper, the News Herald, and some of the different websites, mlive.com, michiganradio.com, metrotimes.com, et cetera, et cetera, to give you an idea of what's been going on. And, of course, we try to fill in the blanks and tell you why. My name is Jay Koronek, by the way. Just accidentally, that's what my parents called me, so that's what I am, who I am. And happy to be with you today. So we're looking at the papers of the last week, and just to update you on a few headlines from there. Press and Guide from last Sunday, April 30th, mentions that there's another business in West Dearborn that's closing, but of course that's always the way. If you look at the big picture over a couple of decades or more, in my case, buildings and businesses do close for a number of logical reasons. Either they relocate or perhaps the owners are retiring and they just decide to close the business because of that. And that's actually a good reason for them anyway, if it's their time to retire. Of course, sometimes it's because of either declining business so that they're losing money. The story is this time relates to Lynch's. It was a costume rental shop. And I guess you could buy things there, too. For nearly seven decades, 70 years, Lynch's Costume Shop has been a go-to spot for young dancers getting their first pair of point shoes, that's P-O-I-N-T-E, as well as for Halloween revelers looking for that perfect costume. But the popular store is packing up to close later this summer as owner Patrick Lynch prepares to retire. That was the retirement thing. He's 57, The business has been going on before that. Let's see. I'll turn to page 5. Was it his dad that started it then? He's too young to go back 70 years. Okay. Let's take a look. Yeah, his grandmother, Eleanor Lynch, opened the store in 1949, and it's been at the current location on Howard Street, just north of Michigan Avenue, since 1972. So, and for the last 40 years, Patrick and his wife, Susan, have run the business with a long time, two long time employees, and one is a cousin, by the way. There's nothing in the story about what's going to happen there. If the property has been sold already or if there's another business coming in, we don't know about that. But a great specialty service, and that's what's so great about local business is that they provide things that we can't get on the internet or the personal service that we can't get on the internet. And so support your local businesses of all kinds, at least while they're here. And let's see if there's something else I wanted to mention from that paper. This is the new WHFR Journal. We're making waves. So we're the only local news show on the radio airwaves that where you can hear the pages turning. Yep. And we're doing that right now. Oh, my goodness. So many pages here. Nope. That's all I wanted to mention from that. But the Press and Guide from this Wednesday, May 3rd, does have the story I've been looking for a while, and that is, who are the final candidates going to be for local elections? Especially local are, of course, the city of Dearborn and the city of Dearborn Heights. There's always a question about, even if people so-called take out petitions, they take petitions from the city clerk's office to fill out with so many names, I don't know, 100, 200, and in order to get on the ballot. They have to turn them back in, though. Okay. Now, there's also the story that I read here doesn't say anything about an additional deadline. The deadline, I think, was the 25th or 26th of April, last week sometime. But there's usually a couple of days that they have to actually go back on the petition that they turned in. In other words, they decide not to run, even though they filled out the petition, they had enough names, they would technically qualify, but they still have a chance to say, forget about it. Okay. But apparently they waited for the story long enough so that deadline, whatever it was, a couple of days or a week, has passed. So here's the story, if you hadn't already heard. Dearborn's current mayor, John B. O'Reilly Jr., is seeking to retain the office. He's one of the people. And in Dearborn Heights, the current mayor, Daniel Poletko, is also running again. O'Reilly will battle four challengers, and that's going to be Pro Tem Thomas Tefelsky. That's City Council President Pro Tem. He got the second highest number of votes in the last election for City Council. And businessman Hakeem Fakuri, Jim Pirelli, and resident Edward Binkley. So those are the four names going up against the mayor. In the August 8th primary election, I believe that that number will be reduced to two. Certainly in the August 8th primary, the city council numbers will be reduced, but not that much. So here's the story about the city council in Dearborn. We have five incumbents out of the seven that are running, okay, are seeking re-election. Robert Abraham, Dave Bozzi, Susan DeBaggia, current president, that is, highest vote getter from the last election, Brian O'Donnell, and Michael Cerini. And, of course, not Tom Tefelsky. So if Tom Tefelsky doesn't make it as president, no, he's not. He's already a president pro tem. But if he doesn't make it for mayor, then he won't be on the city council. So he'll be gone from the city council if he loses his challenge to the mayor. Well, either way, he won't be on the city council, but he may be mayor. So he had to make a choice of running for mayor or be running for a city council because all those seats are up for re-election here and he can't run for two at the same time. The challengers are Ziad Abdulmalik, Nada Alhanouti, Farouz Bazzi, Aaron Burns, Sharon Domage, Regan Ford, Sean Green, Rifat Hasham, Ramez Hidar, Leslie Herrick, and Kenneth Paris. So, all together, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. So there's 11 challengers. Now, that means that on the primary, ballot on August 8th, the primary election ballot in Dearborn for city council, there'll be 16 names. However, since the city council has to be made up of seven people who finally get elected, the primary is only going to whittle the field down a little teeny bit from 16 to 14. In other words, two challengers supposedly for each available seat of seven. Although it's just a matter of who gets the most votes, they're just taking the top seven vote getters to be elected in the November ballot. So actually, almost all of the challengers, and again, there's 11 challengers, there's only going to be two less going into November. So 9 of the 11 will definitely be also in the running in November. And that's just the way it goes. But it seems to me that that's, you know, what's the need of a primary if all you're doing is reducing the number by two? Of course, if you didn't have the primary, who knows? There might be 20, 30, 40 people running for city council. And that would probably just be too much. It would result in the people that get elected, the highest vote getters, might get elected with only like 5% of the total vote if there was 220 or 30 people. Who knows? It would just split up the numbers so that is this person, if they're supported by 5% of the community, let's say, are they deserving of being council president if they're the top vote getter with only 5%? So we always like to do things with majorities, but in this case, it's the highest vote getters. And even Susan DiBaggio didn't get a majority, I don't think, last time. I think she got 40%. She was on the one of the top seven. But in terms of votes cast, she only got about 40% of the people voting that put her name down. So she wasn't a majority. Well, of course, President Trump is not a majority elected president. I'm sorry. Everybody knows this, except him, is that the popular vote went to Hillary Clinton nationwide, but he won the Electoral College, and that's fair and square. Nobody's debating that. But he's still debating whether or not he didn't also get the popular vote, which is, he can say what he wants to say, facts don't seem to prove that out. Anyway, what else is happening? Well, in the city clerk's position, our former state representative from this area, George Durrani, is running for that. Also, a John Joseph Shimizi, Nofila Hadar, Amir Yusuf Absala, and Adam Ali. And those are the contenders. Now, I'm not sure what the primary will do. Will it reduce those 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 people to 2? Article doesn't say. That's my assumption, though. I'll take the top 2 out of those 5. In Dearborn Heights, what's happening? Well, again, the mayor is seeking his 4th term in office. He's got only 2 challengers, unlike Mayor O'Reilly, who has 4. Again, in the primary, will Mayor O'Reilly's 4 challengers be reduced to just 2? Or not? I don't know. That's what I think is going to happen. And we'll get back to you on that. It's just something that the article ought to have in it. I'm sorry. I just hate to be a critic of people that are hardworking journalists in the situation that they have to work these days, all part-time and rushed and so on, these other couple questions don't get answered. They're minor, I know, but you'll find out when you get into the ballot box in August, on August 8th. You'll find out how many are on there and how many you can vote for. So there. But over in Dearborn Heights, to finish the story, we have Mayor Poletko being challenged by Lisa Hicks Clayton, who was a current councilwoman, and also Crestwood School Board Trustee Ed Garcia, who was also a former Dearborn Heights police officer, who had a lot of... And so Lisa Hicks Clayton has been maybe thinking about this run, has been very busy in the community for the last couple of years, especially this last year. She got a lot of stories. She did a lot of special council person-sponsored forums for the public out there on different topics. which is a good thing to do. You know, as much discussion from the residents as you can manage is good. But especially if you're running for mayor soon, but you know, get your name out there. And Trustee Ed Garcia, the former Dearborn Heights police officer, was known as Officer Ed, and was also involved in a anti-drug campaign in the public schools on behalf of the police department for many years. And he got a lot of positive community support from that position. And now, I mean, certainly he did get elected to the school board in Crestwood, too. So he's got some supporters. So that's going to be an interesting race. People with three different backgrounds there running. But out there in Dearborn Heights, the clerk's position and the treasurer's position are unchallenged. So no one else is running against Clerk Walter Przewitz and Treasurer John Riley. Przewitz has served as clerk since 2011 for 6 years, and Riley has been treasurer since 1994. So he ought to know what the job is all about, right, by this time. Council members Tom Berry, Bob Constan, Margaret Horvath, and Joseph Kosinski are up for re-election. Berry and Constan have thrown their hats into the race, but Horvath and Kosinski will not seek re-election. Okay, so there's four open council seats. So challengers are hoping to claim one of the four open council seats. So there's a real good chance, just like I think there was a couple of years ago. I mean, the odds are, when there's not as many people running and a lot of open seats, four open seats, how many people are running for that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. So 9 running for 4 seats. And who are those 9? Ali Almuna, Ned Apigian, former council member, Mo Badoon, Bill Bazzi, Jeff Mollad, Denise Maxwell, Larry Mitchell, Lisa Oshansky, and Tom Wenzel. Okay, and I don't know any backgrounds. We'll try to get into that on this show, of course, whenever we find out more background information. I'm sure League of Women Voters, Dearborn Heights, is going to try to organize some special debates, forums, to have these people, especially the many people running for city council in both areas, to have discussions that the public can attend. And if possible, here on the Journal, we'll try to get as many of these candidates, especially for the mayor's position, who are challengers. That's the way we do it here. If you don't know about the incumbent, then they mustn't be doing a very good job. I don't know. If you don't know that they've been doing a good job, then maybe they haven't. I don't know. I'm just saying, if you keep up with politics, certainly the person who's been in office should be someone that you'll be able to remember some of the person's background and some of the significant things they've done for you. Also, we only have so many shows, and some of these people will not respond to us, but certainly anyone running as a challenger for Dearborn or Dearborn Heights mayor and for Dearborn City Council, challengers, again, or Dearborn Heights City Council, we will give you time on the air. And the only person I probably can't is Ned Apigian, because I think he's a current member of WHFR. Now, maybe if he drops out of WHFR, we could have him on. We do, just so all the candidates know this, we will schedule 1 half-hour interview and only one per show, so there's no debate going on. We just decided not to do it that way. I won't go into reasons why. But everybody gets a full half hour, and they get the same questions that the other people get for the same position. Okay, so get a whole half hour to tell what you want, and it's for free. So any of the campaign managers out there or candidates that are listening right now, or tell if they're a friend of yours and you're listening right now, tell them they have that opportunity. They just have to contact me, Jay Koronik, here at WHFR. You can send me an email to whfr@hfcc.edu and just put in their candidate interview on the Journal or journal interview or something in the subject line, and it'll get forwarded to me within a day or so, and then we'll take care of the scheduling. And of course, you get to decide whether you want to do it now, like the next month, or do you want to do it right before the August election, or do you want to, in some cases, especially with the Dearborn City Council challengers, maybe you want to just schedule an election, assuming you will be on the ballot in November, somewhere in the fall. You only get one, okay? Because the questions would be the same, whether it's before the primary or whether it's before the general election. And it's one per show. So we only have a couple dozen shows at most between now and November. So challengers, let me know. Half an hour for free. And the only thing you can't do is specifically criticize or attack the other candidates. So you can only talk about yourself, the person I think you know best, I would assume. Just to let you know, we're just trying to play fair there. No negative campaigning is allowed on this show. Okay. Is that the same thing as Bill Riley's no spin zone? No, that's something different. And he's going no anyway. So there you go. So that'll be exciting. Again, local elections. Local is what matters the most, usually affects you the most in your daily life in these cities, and therefore they should matter the most to you. Okay, it's in the paper, but I'll mention some events coming up for the next couple of days here. Let's see. Tonight, the Dearborn Symphony Orchestra has their final performance for the season. It's a special theme, A River Runs Through It, which was a movie years ago, but this is, they're not going to show the movie. It's a lot of things about well, you can't tell by the titles, but it's a lot of things about nature and the world we live in and so on. We have composers Bedrich Smetana. James Walters has written a piece entitled Detroit Through the River of Time, featuring the Children's Honors Choir. James Walters is the same person who gives a little concert preview at 7 p.m. at the Ford Community Performing Arts Center. The concert performance tonight starts at 8 p.m. You can get tickets at the door, I assume. They're also doing a piece by Tchaikovsky and Brahms and Mozart and Franz von Suppe, which is his Poet and Peasant Overture, and performing will be the Dearborn Youth Symphony side by side, which I assume side by side with the Dearborn Symphony Orchestra. So their final performance for this season is tonight. And quite a varied spectrum of programs, and should be very, very entertaining. There's nothing like live music, whether it's symphonic type stuff, classical pieces, or blues or indie rock or whatever. You need to get out of the house more, folks. Stop binge watching TV and watching those news channels 24/7. That can be hazardous to your health right there. And appreciate the social event of live music performances. And certainly our Dearborn Symphony Orchestra performances are fine indeed. Saturday, this Saturday, May 6th, tomorrow, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., at Green Brain Comics in this area, but I think every comic book store, it's free comic book day. So a lot of special free stuff that'll be given out. And that's why we mention it. Free comics, kids activities, artists are going to be there, Artist Alley, maybe they're signing autographs, and also prizes given. You don't have to buy anything, so that's why we can mention it, because obviously Green Brain and the other comic stores are for-profit operations. But once a year, this is always exciting, fun to do, just like the Indie Record Store Day was a week or so ago. In this case, Green Brain Comics is on the east side of Dearborn on Michigan Avenue, east downtown Dearborn, Michigan Avenue. Again, 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. tomorrow, May 6th. And then on Sunday, what else? Well, the Vanguard Voices in Brass, under the direction of G. Kevin Dewey, are going to be celebrating their 25th anniversary with a May 7th concert. It is the season-ending performance. It's going to be at Guardian Lutheran Church. And they're going to do several pieces. Sunday, May 4th, by the way, Guardian Lutheran Church here in Dearborn, beginning at 4 p.m. There's going to be a 65-voice mixed chorus and also a 24-voice Vanguard chorale doing pieces. And then the Vanguard Brass Ensemble will produce, will present more works. Let's see here. If you don't know, Guardian Lutheran Church is located at 24544 Cherry Hill, just west of Telegraph. So it's on Cherry Hill and just west of Telegraph. So it's probably not far over there because it's in the city of Dearborn. Mm-hmm. And tickets are, that's not free. Tickets, general admission, are $15 at the door and $6 for students. I don't know if that's, if you have to get the student tickets in advance at the centers, that is the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center box office, which will be open even on Saturday from 11 a.m. to 7 p.m. So you get advance tickets for adults at $13 and $6 for students. Probably need ID, I guess. I don't know when. Maybe when you buy the tickets. So Vanguard Voices, by the way, is sponsored by the Dearborn Recreation and Parks Department and Choir in Residence Program at Henry Ford College. Of course, G. Kevin Dewey is one of our fine full-time music instructors here in our music area. Highly recommend that. That's going to be great. Okay. Now I think it's time to have a commentary. And let's see here. Jim Hightower talks about the post office, the United States Post Office. I love them.
A half dollar hardly counts as money these days. It won't even buy a cup of coffee. But psst. Here's an amazing half-dollar bargain for you. A first-class postage stamp. For 50 cents, you get the stamp, 3 cents in change, and America's phenomenal network of post office workers and letter carriers who deliver your missive into any of the 43,000 zip codes of this vast country. Our public postal service literally delivers, and many of our post offices serve as treasured community centers. Two reasons that the U.S. Mail Service consistently ranks highest of all federal agencies in public support. So, naturally, it must be decimated and ultimately eliminated. That's what passes for logic in the back rooms of Congress and in the boardrooms of predatory corporations that want to take control of our mail for their profit. They keep demonizing anything public, especially any public service that actually works and is popular. Because the corporate powers and the Congress critters they buy in bulk ultimately intend to privatize all of the people's government. To advance their plutocratic vision, they're out to tarnish the Postal Service as a massive, money-sucking, dying, bureaucratic behemoth. But here are a few facts they don't want you to realize. One, this public agency provides affordable mail service to all, in poor communities as well as rich. Two, it does this without a dime of taxpayer money, financing its entire operation with the sale of stamps and services. And three, it provides hundreds of thousands of solid middle-class jobs spreading throughout every zip code in America. This is Jim Hightower saying, to help keep this public jewel out of the hands of a few greed-headed, price-gouging, low-wage, tax-dodging corporations, support a Grand Alliance to save our public post offices. Find it at agrandalliance.org.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
It's pointed out by Jim Hightower in another commentary that he also has available. You can go to jimhightower.com, of course, at any time and listen to his wide range of comments on national issues, that a lot of the Republicans and even the Washington Post, which is a newspaper that was bought and is now controlled by relatively conservative, not outright Republican, Jeff Bezos. And he is the owner, originator, founder, whatever, of Amazon.com. And his, you know, the stories are therefore suffer because they're not presented in a fair light, I think, especially the one that Jim Hightower refers to in another commentary that I haven't played today, because it has some words that might be considered bad words, although it just gives the initials of the bad words, not the actual bad words. So is it bad if there's only the initials? Anyway, we're not going to play that. But one of the facts about the post office is it's making money every year. Okay? And it doesn't take any federal funds. That's right. The government doesn't have to put a penny into any of the operation, including staffing, of the post office. So they're completely supported by the by their services. That is, people buying stamps and postage and boxes and collectible stamps and so on. And yet, Washington Post and Republicans want to privatize it all. Just get rid of the post office and let private companies do it. Well, that's just so crazy. I mean, private companies don't have the organization, they don't have the locations, they don't have the staff. How could they ever cover the whole United States and do a better job than our U.S. Postal Service? Certainly not for dozens of years. And, you know, we do have FedEx and UPS, and certainly there can be competition to the U.S. Postal Service, but why should you eliminate the U.S. Postal Service from doing a great job, just like in education? Why should you undercut public education, who's already doing a good job nationwide, for the sake of unknown charters or private or parochial schools? I mean, they're unknown qualities and quantities. We just don't know. But the competition is fine. I'm not against that. But don't put public funds into that, and don't cut the public resources we have, especially the post office. Oh, my goodness. Thank you, Ben Franklin. You know, Ben Franklin, historically, he's the one that started our post office back in the 1770s, maybe, 1780s, somewhere in there. And... Why are the Republicans saying that it's $5 billion in debt? It's because the people who have organized it and U.S. Congress, controlled by Republicans, actually came up with an idea that the post office should generate enough money to pay for retirement funds for their staff for 75 years. Now, there's no business or organization in the whole United States that has that requirement. So at this point, technically on the books, they were $5 billion behind this year. But they've made a profit every year, and they don't take any federal funds in order to do this. And by the way, you say, well, 47 cents for a first-class letter, that's expensive. Of course it isn't expensive these days. I mean, a cup of coffee never cost less than a dollar at any sort of business establishment in the outside world, and sometimes $5 for one of those double half cappuccino latte decaf with nutmeg. So 47 cents is a good deal. Look at how much they pay in Canada for a first class letter. Yeah, somebody please look at it, because I don't remember, but the last time I was there, it looked like it was almost 2 to 3 times as much per letter. So certainly our system is doing a great job, and at a very low cost. And so there is no reason why the federal government should not stay, with this, and then close down the post office in favor of privatizing it. That's only going to cause terrible trouble and disruption of our system, and, of course, the loss of jobs for thousands of workers in our postal system who are doing a great job. I wanted to mention that one of the things they do every year, at no extra cost to the Postal Service, the letter carriers are doing this themselves. They have a program each year, and it's coming up a week from tomorrow, Saturday, May 13th. It's their food drive, and it's called Stamp Out Hunger. And so what you do is, okay, you can put your non-perishable donation, either something that comes boxed or in a jar or a can, in a bag, in a paper bag, by your mailbox. Maybe it could be a plastic bag, I don't know. But you know, and put it in a bag by your mailbox, like right below it, beside it or whatever, early in the day before the postman gets there that Saturday. And they're going to pick it up and deliver it to a local food bank. Actually, what happens, doesn't slow down your mail. Don't worry about that. You usually have an extra person working with them with the truck, and they just go down the street and pick up all the bags and put it in the postal truck and bring it back. And they deliver it to local food banks that need it. And so that's a great thing. And it doesn't, you know, it wasn't organized by the United States Postal Service, but by the letter carriers themselves to give something back to the community. I thank them so much for all the fine, dependable service, even in terrible weather. Somebody always delivers, even if it's at the end of the day. Maybe a lot of people call in sick in that bad weather day, but somebody always gets it to my house by at least 4:30, which is the close of a day, I think. Do we need the Saturday delivery? That's a great convenience. A lot of countries don't have that, by the way. I'm not sure if Canada has Saturday delivery. Yes, they could save money as an operation, but already they're making money every year. They're making a profit, and they're not taking any funds. So why do you need to cut Saturdays out? As it is, I get two or three times the amount of mail on Monday stuffed into my mailbox. I get a lot of mail. I need information. And boy, oh boy, am I on mailing lists. Yes, some of it's advertisements I don't want, but still, if there was an extra day when the mail just piles up at the post office, I don't think it would all fit in my mailbox. And I've got a big mailbox, believe me, because I knew it would be needed, but there's just too much. Of course, the frustrating thing on Saturday deliveries, if I get some sort of business letter that says that I haven't paid a bill or something, oh my God, you know, and that doesn't happen very often, but you can't call anybody because it's a weekend. Most businesses are not open on Saturday, at least their business office isn't. And so you got to wait till Monday, you got to wait for 2 days, not knowing what's happening, or, you know, maybe you're paying an extra fee for two more days just because you can't do anything until the business reopens. So Saturday is kind of problematic. And if I got my mail, of course, before closing on Fridays, then of course I could still make a call before people go home. I'm fine if they don't want to do Saturdays, but that's not something that should be forced on them. And as I said, the current system is working. It is an example of a very good federal program, and we need to keep it, not undercut it. And whoever came up with a 75-year pension fund in advance just to have, I think, a negative point to say so they can privatize and give more local, give more business to the local people that give them money for their next campaign, that's just not right. So that was Jim Hightower's the crux of what he was talking about with that. Okay, this is the new WHFR Journal. My name is Jay Koronek. I'm happy to be with you today. Today is May 5th, 2017. Yesterday was May 4th, also known as International Star Wars Day. May the Force be with you. I'm sorry, may the Force be with you. And there's really, did the movie, the original Star Wars movie, the first one, was it released on May 4th? No, it wasn't. It's just the pun. The 4th, may the 4th be with you. You get the idea. Oh, my goodness. Let's look at news for today from Dearborn and the area. Okay. All right. This last Wednesday, Governor Snyder came to town, and I don't see any crowd protesting because he probably didn't tell anybody he was coming, but they did the official photograph of digging in the dirt. All is interesting, and all the shovels held by Mayor O'Reilly and Governor Snyder and the other two folks there, somebody from Ford Land and Ford Land's director of sales, as well as the CEO of Ford Land Development. It's interesting that all their shovels do not have any dirt on them. So I mean, if they did dig a little bit there, and there are little holes in front of their feet there, I see. So maybe all the dirt just fell off. But, you know, don't necessarily want these chief executives to do too much hard labor, because they do so much hard labor in their own jobs. Sort of an aside, apparently, Mark Zuckerberg, the billionaire fellow that started Facebook, that he actually came to Dearborn in the last week, and he not only made a brief visit to University of Michigan Dearborn to talk to students about how to be a billionaire, I guess, but also he worked for a day at Ford Motor Company in one of the assembly line facilities. He was doing something rather, I thought, minor from the description, but after a day of hard labor at Ford, he said, "This is really hard." Mm-hmm. Yep. Not an easy job. My dad worked all of his life for certainly over 40 years of employment. I think it was over 50 years, actually, of employment at Chrysler Corporation. Finally, he was at the Trenton Engine plant. He was also at the DeSoto plant originally in Detroit when they still made DeSotos. That plant, by the way, has been was raised and torn down, and then they rebuilt rebuilt in that same exact area, and they're making the Jeep Grand Cherokees there. That's what that's become, a brand new factory, new modern factory, and that's where they make, in Detroit, the Grand Cherokee. Yes, that's the name of it. Four-wheel drive SUV, all that. Okay. Anyway, so they were officially commemorating the Wagner Place development, the Wagner Place project, and Governor Snyder and Mayor O'Reilly, you know, we're just saying all kinds of good things. Actually, you know, for the city of Dearborn, they're getting a lot of, they're putting in money for a new parking structure and an area development. But in fact, if you read through the article, which will be in the Press and Guide, if it's not, I don't know, it's not already there. Anyway, the city is investing $8 million through bond financing to build a parking deck and will bond for $7 million in utility improvements and streetscaping in connection with the project. But Dearborn is overseeing the $18 million investment for the West Dearborn area, including Brownfield Redevelopment Authority funds and other financing. The city will make significant utility improvements and streetscaping elements to enhance the project and the area. There's $3 million in support from the Michigan Strategic Fund on that parking deck. So the state of Michigan has contributed also to that development. So it's not all Dearborn. You know, Dearborn's not being exploited by the Ford Motor Company there. And also in the long run, these people that are in these buildings eventually, not just Ford, but some other businesses will be moving in there. And so there's taxes that will be coming back. And that's the usual payback situation for most of these projects. Total cost for Ford is $60 million. They will employ 600 Ford employees there, but as I said, there'll be areas for other businesses to be part of that too. School news. You know that there was a county millage that was approved. The Wayne County RESA, R-E-S-A millage, was approved last fall. But the city the school system in Dearborn is still wondering, specifically, they're investigating how to spend the $7.7 million that they expect to receive annually from the enhancement for 6 years. Only for 6 years, okay? So, I mean, they can't go crazy and just figure that into the budget for every year. But by the way, they also, if you remember, they sold the Howe School, so they have a little bit more fund balance now than they've had before. And that's good because, first of all, they don't have to borrow money and pay $25,000 or so interest to get through between the summer and the fall. The final budget from the state of Michigan may not be approved and doesn't have to be approved, unfortunately, until October, although Governor Snyder has usually completed that budget earlier. It's very hard for the schools to budget what they're going to do with the money if they don't know how much money actually is coming in. And so it does really stop progress for 3-4 months at the beginning of each school year if the budget isn't finalized by the state of Michigan. And it has been for the last couple of years. But, I mean, you can dispute whether or not it's been enough money. And we'll talk about that in the next story. Okay. So at this point, the administrators and staff of Dearborn Public Schools have developed a list of more than 100 areas where the funding could be used. And they've got that down to about 60 ideas now, though, and then ranked these by various groups, different types of projects. The top 20 or so they think could be funded next year, and then the list will be reevaluated each year since they do get 6 years of this, so there might be things that they have to take care of. Some of the ideas in general is restorative practices training, whatever that means, professional learning communities, Dearborn High overcrowding, and that's in the next story too, upgrading playgrounds, more middle school counselors, eliminating pay-to-play fees. Right now for sports events, you can't just have your son or daughter or both volunteer and play sports for free. There is extra money that the parents have to put out. That's called pay to play. And maybe the little bit of extra money here, at least for a few years, could take care of that. Also, reducing elementary class sizes in various ways, I would assume, get some more teachers. And so they're looking at that, but things are good. I do believe that the proposed budget from the state of Michigan, which has only been passed by the Michigan House, according to a story from MLive.com, from a day or so ago, May 2nd, okay, 3 days ago, the House passed a $39.5 billion budget. And now it comes in below the recommendation from the governor. He wanted more money on a number of projects. But in terms of the schools, it looks like maybe $100 more per student in the K-12 system. Now, it still has to go to the Senate to be voted on. And most Democrats were against it in the House, so for a variety of reasons. And so we don't know where that's going to go. But it's interesting that the governor has had a task force about what our school systems need and the amount of money to do all those things. His independent board that he set up, well, of course, the legislature didn't pay any attention to that, apparently. You know, what do the independent people know about running schools, right? Only politicians know the right thing to do with the schools. Yep. Anyway, we don't really know where that's going to go. And again, it might be as late as October before anybody finds out, but at least our Dearborn district will not be too hurt in any specific way. One of those issues about Dearborn, sort of a spinoff from the main discussion, is that they have overcrowding right now in Dearborn at two of their high schools, Dearborn High on the west side, and Fortson High School on the east side are overcrowded, especially Dearborn High. We'll say Dearborn High is going to need some additional classrooms to be built. I don't know if they'll bring in, portable classrooms. If it's a temporary thing, or is it going to be a full-time thing? Anyway, there's so many they're going to have to put some more money in and build on, I guess, or redevelop something that's already in there. And in fact, they think they're going to need so many additional classrooms in West Dearborn, they're even, if they had the money, considering tearing down Dearborn High and building a whole new high school. And that takes a long time, and it will be very, very expensive. And what do you do with the kids who have overcrowded there for the year or two for the demolition and reconstruction? That's unless they pick another site. And they build on the other side, like in the parking lot on the west side of Outer Drive there, across from the high school. They build a new one there, and then they just close down the other one and make it a parking lot eventually, so they could have continuity. But what they're talking about right now is to send more students from east and west to Etzel Ford, which is on the south side of Michigan Avenue. And the current plan they're thinking about is Well, we don't know. I mean, it looks like the boundary lines right now are Michigan Avenue. It's not labeled here whether or not that's the new plan or the old plan. So does Ethel Ford actually take all high school students from Dearborn east and west south of Michigan Avenue now, or is that the plan that's being considered? So will they move the line further north, or take a chunk out of the middle, or what? But they think they can get by, even though they have to build a few extra classrooms on Dearborn High in the west, by putting more students in Ethel Ford. Because apparently Ethel Ford is not at capacity right now. Ethel Ford had only 1,441 students. I don't know what they were designed to accommodate, but Dearborn High last year had over 2,000. And so there's a couple other things. Dearborn High's media program, they suggested, there goes the Russ Gibb media classroom identification. They'll have to move it. They're thinking of moving it to the Michael Berry Career Center. Well, that won't make it as easy for students to attend. They'll need special transportation to get over there, which is at the former Henry Ford College Dearborn Heights campus that's now owned by the Dearborn Public Schools. So it's up Outer Drive near what? Ann Arbor Trail? Oh, well. So they're working on proposals there, and but overcrowding is a big problem. So there you go. But they will have a little bit more money to help resolve the needs from year to year, but only for 6 years. And then the extra RISA, Wayne County millage of $7.7 million a year will be gone. Okay, also another story about the schools here. We're going to have a change in the board of the Board of Education for the K-12. And, you know, those same people also meet every month as the Henry Ford College Board of Trustees. And the current president of the Dearborn School Board of Education and Henry Ford College Board of Trustees is Miriam Bazzi. Well, she has just been named to the post of Third Circuit Court Judge in Wayne County. So she's going to become a big-time circuit court judge. And Governor Snyder made that appointment this last Tuesday. Now, she has been an assistant Wayne County prosecuting attorney since 2006. And as I mentioned, she's the chairwoman or president of Henry Ford College's Board of Trustees, as well as the president of the Board of Education. And now she must seek election in November for that circuit court judge. And will need to run again in seek election in November 2018. So she should have been appointed circuit court judge for 14 months, 15 months. And then she needs to run again in 2020 for a full term to come up. And so she's 38 years old and has accomplished a lot and so on. It doesn't say in the story, but I've just talked to Michael Mead, who's on that same Board of Education, he's one of the Board of Trustees. Just saw him at a luncheon here at the college to honor retiring Henry Ford College teachers for this year. And I've known Mike from his early days here as Dean of Students and even acting president of Henry Ford College, Henry Ford Community College then. So I've known him for decades, if you will, in those professional roles. And he mentioned, because I asked him, I said, can Miriam Bazzi continue in her part-time job with the Dearborn Board of Ed and Board of Trustees? And he said, nope, she can't. And that by the end of May, she's going to be gone, since she's already been appointed. She's already judge. And so by the end of May, she's going to be leaving the board, and they're going to have to find someone else. And how do they do that? Well, it's not like the city council that just takes the next highest vote getter in the last election. They actually have, according to Mike, and if I'm getting it correct, if I'm not, I apologize to Mike, but I believe they will ask for people to submit a letter of application to be appointed by the board, and so all the people will be interviewed who did send in a letter, and then the board of trustees will make a decision and appoint someone in there until the next term of office, until that term of office comes up again to be elected. I'm not sure. I don't think that's this fall, but maybe it is. But they're going to fill the vacancy almost immediately in about a month or so. And so if you're interested in being on the Dearborn Board of Education and at the same time be part of the Board of Trustees of Henry Ford College, contact someone at the board office and ask what kind of letter they want and get that letter in. But congratulations to Miriam Bozzi, who is now a Third Circuit Court judge in Wayne County. Okay. That's the school issues. All right. With only about 6 minutes before 2 o'clock, Kitty Love and Highway 61 is going to be starting up at the Best in the Blues today from 2 to 4. And at 4 o'clock, Mike Holloway comes in with his blues show from 4 to 6, Go With the Flow, Mike Holloway Show. So you want to stay tuned. It's a great way, thank goodness it's Friday. It's a great way to spend your Friday afternoon leaving work or getting everything together for the weekend, whatever you're thinking of doing. And please listen to WHFR a lot and tell your friends, of course. It's our 32nd year. Oh, if you know someone that doesn't know we're on the air and that we're different and alternative and play music that other stations don't and even have certain talk shows that other people don't have, then tell them. Please let them know. There's still time because we're still here. Here's an event coming up. It should be a lot of fun. One of the people that appeared on this show, since I'm kind of a car guy, like automobiles and had many different types and test-driven quite a few. And, of course, my dad was working in that Chrysler Corporation plant, but he wasn't, he was just on the assembly line. One step above, he was fixing the machines that break down all the time on the assembly line. But here's what's coming up. It's at the, and this is a benefit to support the Lincoln Park Historical Museum. Lincoln Park Historical Museum. They're having a speaker to come in, and he's written a book about Preston Tucker, who came up with the Tucker Torpedo automobile back in 1948. There was a movie, if you remember, called Tucker, The Man and His Dream, starred Jeff Bridges. I think there was another one or two and some documentaries, too, about that. But anyway, this event will feature you might say, friend of this show, because he appeared on the show with his one of his first books, Steve Lehto, L-E-H-T-O. And his first book that we actually had him in here for a discussion was on the Chrysler turbine car, way ahead of its time. It had a turbine engine, which is you could also call a jet engine in it, and it was safe to drive in public and just a little expensive to operate in the late 1950s, early 1960s, very expensive to build. But today it could be built a lot easier, a lot more efficiently, probably would work just fine now. Jay Leno, the late night host on NBC's talk show for decades, actually wrote the introduction to that book and also wrote the introduction for his latest book, which is Preston Tucker and His Battle to Build the Car of Tomorrow. And that book came out late last fall, and it's an easy read, but it's great background. I know there's been some other biographies about Preston Tucker, but he's going, anyway, Steve Lehto is going to be talking about his book and about Preston Tucker at the Lincoln Park Historical Society, and that's going to happen 6 p.m. on Thursday, May 18th. It's their annual dinner. And he is the guest speaker. It is $20 to Historical Society members of, again, Lincoln Park, and $25 for non-members. Maybe Steve will sign his book for you. Maybe he even has some that you could buy there. You can make reservations, and you can just call the Lincoln Park Historical Society. In the article, they leave out the last four digits. This is from the News Herald. They leave out the last four digits of the number, so I can't give it to you. But that's, again, Thursday, May 18th, 6 p.m., Steve Leto, talking about his book, Preston Tucker and His Battle to Build the Car of Tomorrow. Very interesting story and background. I have the book right here, ready for an autograph, but Steve's not here to sign it today. Okay. 3 minutes. Not much time left, and Kitty Love is totally organized here and got all of her things in place to start the fantastic blues show. I don't know what else I can tell you here, but an awful lot of stories, local stories, even one from the Metro Times that was just posted yesterday when the U.S. House of Representatives moved to repeal the Affordable Care Act, that is Obamacare, and replace it with a plan that, in fact, according to the Metro Times story, guts protections for people with pre-existing conditions. It's also got all kinds of other problems, too, with it. And so you can go to metrotimes.com, although the story will probably be in the Metro Times paper that will come out next week, Wednesday. But you can go right to their website and read about that. Take a read at newsherald.com, and Craig Foran talks about the presidential budget plan that Donald Trump released last week. It was just one page, no details, but it looks bad for everybody except rich people. We could have guessed about that. What's interesting about the health care, I'll just tell this one story, is that the Prime Minister of Australia came to visit our president, Donald Trump. Keep choking up when I say that. Got to drink more tea during the show. And in greeting him, he said, thank you for coming all the way from Australia, all the way around the world, blah, blah, blah. You've really got a great healthcare system there in Australia. Really got a fantastic system, better than ours. And, of course, what kind of a healthcare system do they have there in Australia? It's universal single-payer plan. Kind of like what Donald Trump was saying when he was running for election. He sounded like a real populist and said, we're going to ensure in our new plan, going to appeal Obamacare, and in our new plan, we're going to have insurance for everyone, okay, which is going to be cheaper than what you're paying now, and better, higher quality. Well, so many countries, Canada, France, Germany, and England, and Australia, and New Zealand too, have universal single payer. And according to all national studies, international studies, they all have cheaper health care per person and yet higher quality in terms of results than we do with our mishmash of programs and inconsistencies and so on. I just thought that was great, that every now and then either Trump is accidentally or on purpose contradicting himself, or he actually speaks the truth. And, of course, you can pick and choose what you think the truth is, since he will usually go and flip-flop back and forth at different times. But he actually commended the Prime Minister of Australia yesterday for having such a fantastic healthcare program. And it was universal single-payer, which is not